Hello and welcome to SAN Security 660, Advanced Penetration Testing, Exploit Writing, and Ethical Hacking. My name is Steve Sims. I'm the lead author of the course. You'll hear two different voices. It's going to start with me here in the introduction, and then James Shoemaker will take over and teach book one and book two. I will be teaching the remainder of the course after that point. But just for the intro here, I'm going to be doing this portion. So first, I want to tell a quick story as to how this course came to be. Now, back, I would say, almost 10 years ago, I've been teaching for SAN since around 2006, and about 10 years ago, I had a course called 709, and it was a six-day course on nothing but exploit writing. It wasn't a very successful course, and I believe it was just a little bit ahead of its time in regard to how many people were doing exploit dev as a full-time position. So Ed Skotus and I, we got together and said, what would be the most useful content from 709 in an advanced pen testing course? So not 6 days of exploit dev, but maybe a couple days spent on exploit dev. So we took a section from 709 and we put that into this course 660. And then we built up around it other content that we'll get into here shortly. But I just wanted to kind of give a quick introduction as to how this course initially came to be. Now, with this course, we're going to cover a lot of additional items. Like day one, we're going to start off with network penetration testing. And by that, I mean pen testing network devices and protocols and technology. So things like routers and switches. We'll then in book two get into pen testing cryptographic implementations. We'll get into post exploitation and looking at things like once you get your initial infiltration and access into an environment, how you would go about doing post exploitation activities. And those are the sections that Jim or James will be taking you through. Now, starting with book three, we're going to get into product security testing. We'll look at Python for penetration testing, which is a brand new module that focuses on Python 3 now. And then we'll spend the rest of that book on fuzzing. So looking at different fuzzers, both a bit of time spent on network protocol fuzzing. In the appendix, we've got a section on file format fuzzing. Just so you have that as well, but we wanted to take the time spent in the actual course and lecture to focus on things like code coverage, both block-based code coverage, where if you don't have the source code, how would you go about measuring that coverage, as well as if you do have the source code, how you would go about doing source code-assisted fuzzing and measure your code coverage from that perspective. And that's going to lead us into book four and book five, which are going to spend time on both Linux exploit development and then Windows exploit development. And then we'll finish the course up with a capture the flag. So that's kind of a very high level layout of what we'll be going through and a little bit of history as to how the course came to be. Now there is another course I'm the lead author on called 760, and that is a 6 day 100% exploit dev course. And I'll mention that at times as we go through the material in this course. So moving forward here, each book is going to have a table of contents in the beginning, and you can see red, bold, and bolden areas where the exercises are. Now, with this course, we kept the exercises in line with the course modules. So you'll go from a module straight to an exercise, and then you'll continue. And we feel like it flows a little bit better for this course as opposed to having the exercises in a separate lab workbook. And you'll see that as we go through. We'll also be challenging you and saying, okay, so we've reached an exercise. Here's what we expect you to do. Here's the goal. Here's how it maps to your place of work, your place of employment. And we'll try to set you up for success. And then what we want you to do is approach the labs kind of however you want to approach them. If you want to take what we tell you that you're supposed to accomplish or do and try to do it on your own a bit first prior to going through the walkthrough, that's totally fine. And that's a great thing to do because then you'll learn a little bit more by seeing what you did correctly or maybe where you need to improve. And then you can go through the walkthrough and see again how you did and get to completion. So it really does help teach the content if you do try it yourself first before just going through the walkthrough. So I know I'm repeating myself there, but I just feel it's important to take that approach. And then there'll be a complete walkthrough by the instructor. So myself or Jim will do the actual walkthrough and you'll be able to follow that along as well. So again, approach it however you want. If you hit a certain lab and you feel that it would be better for you to just do the walkthrough or listen to the recording, that's completely fine. And you can always go back, of course, and do it again. So again, this table of contents, you'll see this with each book. So you'll see a lot of exercises each day. So this would be the course roadmap slide that you'll see in each book. And obviously those are the module titles and the exercises, and you can follow through accordingly. Now, this first module is going to be a course overview. And again, it will be me doing a lecture for this portion. And then the actual content of this book will be done by Jim. So each module as well will have an objective section to kind of just remind you what the purpose of this module is and what you should gain, what knowledge you should gain from this section. So I already did a very high level summary. I'll go into a little bit more detail now. First off, what is advanced penetration testing? That's going to have a different meaning to who, depending on who you ask. For me, I've worked in security for like 15 years or so. I've been doing exploit dev for well over 10 years. And when working in the realm of penetration testing, let's say, for example, I used to work at Wells Fargo. I was a security architect, but that really didn't mean anything. It meant that you work on whatever they need you to work on, right? So penetration testing or assisting with the interview process or hiring of those types of specialized areas or roles, I would be involved in. So for me, advanced penetration testing is someone who's able to solve problems where others maybe couldn't find a solution. So say, for example, you're running a Metasploit module against a target and you type an exploit, you hit enter, and it fails. Well, one of the things I used to do in the interview process, depending on the role or whoever we're trying to hire, is I'm a very practical, hands-on interviewer. So I like to not talk about your resume so much, and because I'll assume other people have already done that and you've been triaged or you've been kind of gone through the process there. But I want to focus on hands-on skills. So let's get your hands on a keyboard as quickly as possible, and you show me what you're capable of. And one of those that I would do is I would say, okay, here's a Metasploit module, and the candidate is watching me, and I'm going to type exploit against a Windows target and show you that it works. So, okay, I got a shell in the remote system. And now I'm going to go and turn on data execution prevention on the target Windows system, and I'm going to run exploit again, and you're going to see that the module fails because it's missing a ROP chain or something to change permissions in memory in order to be able to get that exploit working. And so I would say, now have at it. Now you've got 30 minutes or so, whatever we would give you, to go and complete that exercise. And I would expect you to be able to use tools like Mona inside Immunity Debugger or Windebug or whatever, and be able to generate a ROP chain, get that into the exploit, and get it working. Now that would be, of course, a moment where you would realize that either, oh yeah, I absolutely know how to do that, or you'd say, uh-oh, I probably fibbed a little bit on the application process, because obviously in the application or in the job posting, it would say we expect you to be able to do some exploit development, right? So I know I went on a little bit of a tangent there, but that's a long-winded way of saying, to me, that's a little bit of what advanced penetration testing is. Also, like I said before, day one or book one is on network attacks. These are more unorthodox methods of getting into a target environment, maybe a little bit more of the red teaming aspect, where it's not just a super small scope, even though, of course, we've got to stay in scope when we're doing a penetration test and follow the rules of engagement, but we expect you to already know those things in this course. And if one of the possible ways of getting into the target environment is by exploiting a network device or something a bit more unorthodox, that's going to be more of an advanced area. Also, things like cryptographic implementations. A lot of pen testers, at least in my experience, don't have the skill set required to be able to go and deal with cryptographic implementations and look for vulnerabilities in those implementations. So that's the kind of idea behind what advanced penetration testing. And it's subjective, and you could have someone else, they could have a completely different definition for it, and that's fine. I'm just trying to let you know kind of where our heads were when building this course. So first off, network attacks, that's book one. And I've already been talking about this a bit already. So let's talk about some of the things you'll be doing in book one. So again, the network's full of opportunities, and we may be able to target something like NAC. Think about NAC, which is network access control, or network, there's different definitions of it. Network access control, a couple of them will come back to me. But either way, it's a control that governs who is able to access a network. And there's different ways. Admission control is the other one I was trying to think of. So network admission control, network access control. Let's talk about a couple different scenarios. One could be you go into a coffee shop or you go onto a university campus and you see an access point and it's called student network or something, or you go into a coffee shop and it says public coffee Wi-Fi and you join it. And when you join and you go to try to go to Google, it redirects you to a captive portal server. And we've all seen them at hotels as an example as well, where it says, welcome to, you know, Caesar's Palace, network portal. And in order to access the internet, you need to put in your room number and your last name, and it's going to bill your room $10 per day or something like that. Or welcome to the student network. And in order to join this network, please enter your student ID and your password. So it's some weak level of control in the way that wants you to authenticate prior to accessing the internet or the network resource. Now, I say that that's weak because it's something you might be able to do a man-in-the-middle attack on and do like SSL stripping and gain access that way. Or it's something where maybe there is the session management is based on something like the IP address and the MAC address, and you could just change your IP and MAC to someone who's already accessing that network, and you can basically impersonate them. It's like stuff like that, very, very weak level of control versus something like an enterprise NAC that's going to be much more strict, where it's going to do a lot more checking. And those are the things Jim is going to take you through in book one. So I'm already going too much into detail here, but I'm just giving you an example of the kind of thing you're going to cover, or we're going to cover in book one of this course. And then, of course, we'll get into 802.1x and how you target that, getting a man-in-the-middle position, and not just with ARP cache poisoning. Yes, that's an easy way. It's been around for a long time. It still works in a lot of cases. But there might be controls in place like dynamic ARP inspection and other things, DHCP snooping, that try to prevent you from being able to do that. So we want to look at things like IP version 6 man-in-the-middle, things like going after a routing protocol. So in the course, you're going to go after OSPF, and you're going to do this wide-scale man-in-the-middle attack where instead of having the requirement and dependency of being on the local network, you can actually hack remotely. So with ARP cache poisoning, you've got to be on the same subnet. With going after the routing protocols, you might be able to hack someone in Singapore or in London who is on the same, a part of the same enterprise network as your target, from San Francisco. You can do it remotely as long as you're on the same overall network, not just a subnet, but now you're on the same overall network. So really, really cool stuff. So we'll do that. You look at VLAN hopping, SSL downgrade attacks, and other types of man in the middle. So that's a lot of interesting stuff. Again, it's not normally done in a penetration test, either because it's not in scope. And if it's not in scope, why isn't it in scope? Is it because the requester doesn't understand that that's even an option? Are they scared you might break something, which is fair, right? But that doesn't mean you shouldn't test it. So maybe building it in the lab, a replica in the lab, or doing a configuration review and showing them how you would have exploited this might be good enough. Maybe you're doing a red team exercise where the rules are a little bit more loose and you can actually do these things as long as you stay within scope, of course. So there's a lot of really cool stuff to look at there. And the other reason that it might not be done is because the pen tester or the company doesn't know how to do it safely. It's not something they have experience with. So it's good knowledge to have regardless. So in book two, you're going to get into cryptography, and you're going to spend probably almost the first half of the book, or like 3 hours, on pen testing cryptographic implementations. A lot of pen testers avoid it because of mathematics, right? They're afraid of the math involved. But we're really not going to be going after the ciphers themselves. We're going to go after the implementation of. Think about WEP. We all know WEP was just created so we can learn from it, right? Not really, but that's kind of what it feels like. It was had so many things wrong in its implementation where it serves as a great testing or learning opportunity. And it's not just WEP, it's all over the place. So a developer who doesn't quite understand cryptography, it's very common, and they make mistakes when they're implementing crypto into their application. And with some essential skills, you can recognize those failures and those vulnerabilities, and you could potentially exploit them. So we'll be looking at things like hash length extension attacks, CBC mode, bit flipping attacks, padding Oracle attacks, and all these really neat things that have come out over the years. And then the second half of book two is focusing on escape. So escaping restricted environments like a lockdown kiosk or other type of system, and also post-exploitation. So looking a lot at PowerShell, Empire, and those types of tools that allow you to do really neat things. And yes, PowerShell Empire was recently, the project was recently ended, I guess you could say, from the original authors who are at Spectre Ops, but there's been a fork of it and it's been picked up, and there are other tools as well that we'll go over and that you can use. So in book three, we're going to get into scripting skills. Again, we'll start off with a product security module first, and I'll explain what that is when we get there. But then we'll get into pen testing with Python, and we're going to be looking at Python 3, and we just changed it from Python 2 to Python 3, and we've got a really cool new lab for you to do as well, because we all know Python 2.7 or whatever is end of life as of January 2020, so it's definitely time to get off of that. But the idea here is there are a ton of scripting languages and there are a ton of programming languages that are great. You know, we've got Rust, we've got Go, we've got, we've got Lua, Ruby. I mean, there's a ton of them, right? So we had to pick one, and we chose Python for this course because a lot of the tools we use in the course are Python based. Things like Scapy or Scappy, things like Immunity Debugger uses Python, IDA Python with IDA, the disassembler. There's a lot of tools out there or frameworks that were written with Python support. So that's why we're going to use Python. But there's nothing wrong with any of the other languages, of course. But the idea is, in order to be able to do well at advanced pen testing, you've got to be able to automate things. You've got to know how to script to some extent. So we'll talk about that. And then we'll spend the rest of the book with book three on reverse engineering and fuzzing. And as I mentioned earlier, we'll be doing code coverage, we'll be doing network protocol fuzzing, we'll do block coverage and source code coverage using tools like the American Fuzzy Lop and the Sully Fuzzing Framework and others that we'll get into. So book four is Linux exploitation. We've got a pretty heavy module, the first module, that is on memory and how the underlying internals of the operating system work. We'll be getting into things like debugging, but looking at the stack and how the stack operates, how memory is allocated on the stack with the procedure prologue and epilogue. We'll get into linking and loading, and we'll talk about why that's important, and a bunch of other low-level stuff. Another example is virtual to physical address translation, which is important to understand. So again, low-level stuff, we'll get there in book four. After we cover that low-level stuff, we'll spend the rest of the book on Linux exploitation. So when I went and surveyed other courses out there in the space in regards to exploit dev, there's not a whole lot on Linux. There's a lot of great tutorials online that you can look at, and I advocate for that. They definitely go check those out. There's a lot of great books out there. I'm one of the authors of the Gray Hat Hacking book series. It's maybe impartial, but it's a great book for this stuff. And then there's, of course, Hacking the Art of Exploitation, Shellcoder's Handbook, all these great books that have come out over the years that has a lot of this content. So what I did when I wrote this section was I put it into a format that I think is very conducive to learning this stuff, because what I found a lot of times when reading great articles out there and great publications is that there was an expectation that you already had knowledge of certain things. And I'll give you a great example. Back in the early 2000s, when I was learning how to do Windows exploitation, I would go and read a paper written by some, you know, great researcher out there, and they just assumed that I knew what FS segment register offset 30 held. They're like, it would just say, obviously, dereference FS offset 30 and move on. And then they just put it into shell code or something, and they didn't explain what it was. So I go into a debugger and I'm like, what the heck is FS offset 30? FS is a segment register. What does it point to and why? And it took me longer than it should to figure out that FS points to the thread information block when you're in user mode in a Windows process per thread. So if you're under the context of a thread in a Windows user mode process, the FS segment register points to the TIB or the TEB, and offset 30 from where it's pointing is a pointer to the process environment block, or the PEB, which is another user mode structure. And like there were these jumps or these gaps that were missing. So that's what I wanted to put into the course, to organize it in a way where we don't expect you to already know those things. We tell you what they are and why you should care about them. So that's why I feel that taking a course like this is very useful. We don't tell you to try harder and expect you to go figure everything out for yourself. You're not paying for that. Now, I do say and also highly agree that taking the labs, and I said this already, and trying them first is a great learning opportunity. You will learn more by working through and finding a solution on your own. But sometimes you hit a point where that just doesn't make any sense. Like, you're not getting value from that anymore, and it's frustrating, and you need a little bit of help. So that's what we want to do. We want you to try. So the focus, though, on the rest of book four is on Linux Stack Overflows, and not just like the basic Stack Overflows and then we move on. We want to go through, how do you get around modern exploit mitigations like address space layout randomization, like data execution prevention, like stack canaries, and those types of things. And then we do it all again on Windows, on book five. So book five, we're going to pretty much do the same thing that we did in book four, but from the Windows side of the house, and you'll be using a Windows 10 virtual machine that we provided to you. And so it's an enterprise Windows 10 virtual machine. We're going to turn on DEP at some point, and you're going to have to generate a ROP chain to change permissions in memory and get all of that going. So really fun stuff to go through in the last two books after we've gone through all the other things that we addressed previously. So just a reminder here, thinking outside the box, trite or cliche thing to say, but it's important that you understand applications and services and protocols and all these things are built to function. And a lot of developers, they need to make things work. And thinking, having security in mind all the time when you're developing an application is hard, and it's time consuming, and mistakes are made, and we want to go and find those mistakes. As we see every Patch Tuesday with Microsoft, even with a company as brilliant as Microsoft, who have developers who are, you know, cutting edge, same with like Google and Apple, who are on the forefront of exploit mitigations and making it so it's really hard to exploit vulnerabilities, there are still mistakes. There are still bugs that are exploitable. And our job as a penetration tester is to try to identify those, right? And review things like RFCs and determine ways to break these features and these applications. So you want to work through complex problems to find the solution. And in order to do that, you've got to be patient, and you've got to be prepared to be frustrated at times, especially with exploit dev. A lot of this stuff just isn't easy inherently by nature. And when I compare it to when I got started in just tinkering around with exploit dev in the late 90s and Linux and all, when I look back at it now, like back then it was hard. It was novel. People weren't doing it that much. But when I look back now, I'm like, man, that stuff was super easy compared to how things are today. Bad example, but you look at Tony Hawk, the skater, back in the day, and the tricks that he would do were amazing, and I couldn't do them even today. But you look at the skaters nowadays and what they're doing, it's insane. I mean, and even with like guitar playing, you look at the guitar back in the 90s, and there were some great guitars, but you look at the technical skill level of a lot of guitar players now, and it's just different. And that's what you're up against if you're going to get into things like exploit dev nowadays. It's still really useful, and I don't think many would argue that you should still start from the beginning and work your way up quickly and ramp up to the more complex vulnerabilities and such. The end of the course is going to be a capture the flag, and I will intro that and how it works and demo that later on in the course. But for now, that's just an introductory module for the course. So in summary, I think that we covered everything we needed to, which is, a senior penetration tester needs to succeed where others fail. And we want to address some of those things that you, and some of those skills that you want to have in order to be able to do that. And people who can think outside of the box, and people who are patient and put in the work to know how to do scripting and reverse engineering and fuzzing and analyze cryptographic implementations and just keep up to date with the latest and greatest, not only attack techniques, but the defensive techniques, are going to be the most successful.
All right. Thanks, Steve, for the introduction. This next module, this first one that I'm talking about, it's basically just designed to make sure that we are setting you up for success, like the title is here. We want to be sure that are any technical difficulties or challenges that we can address those. Sometimes being an advanced penetration tester is working through those challenges, but not if it prevents you from doing the exercise. So that's really what we want to cover here, just the general setup. And some of you might have to jump through additional hoops, so to speak, a few extra challenges you may have, depending upon your hardware setup or your network connection or other variables that are outside of our control. So don't be surprised if you have to fight through this a little bit to get set up and be happy. Also keep in mind, as we get set up, if you disconnect from the network, you may have to revisit this. It may be working fine one day, and the next day something else goes wrong. So don't assume everything's fine in perpetuity just because it worked once. So let's go ahead and look at some of these things. You should see some pre-configured virtual machines on your thumb drive. There is a Windows 10 image. We've purposely not just put on labs that exercises included already on there, but some of the configuration optimizations are on purpose. We'll cover those each individually per exercise. But I like this Windows 10 image. It's a good representation of what we see in the real world, as well as is very convenient for the classroom settings. As part of this, SANS has basically established with Microsoft a fully legitimate four-month license as with the class to use this Windows 10 image. Beyond that, you have to sort that out with Microsoft. It is a Windows 10 Enterprise, so you have all the features needed for not just for the classroom, but if you want to go beyond what we have, you would have to arrange that directly with Microsoft. SANS won't be a part of the equation any longer. You can create a snapshot before you power it on. It won't take up any additional space on your drive significantly. And that way you can always revert back to a clean version. Your alternative to that is, of course, copying it from the USB drive again and extracting it. It may take some time. Also, too, many of us on our equipment don't have, especially if it's a laptop that's newer, don't have network adapters on the device, our laptop itself, and we're using a USB or other removable dongle device, you might have a challenge where that gets grabbed by a virtual machine and not the host. Mostly what you want to operate from is it on the host. That way all of your virtual machines can use your network adapter. All right. Now, for certain situations, if you want to remove VMware from the equation and you want to maybe pass that USB device directly to a virtual machine, you can. But for most of our exercises, we might need both virtual machines, and you can only have a pass-through device sent to one virtual machine at a time. So the default posture here, if an exercise does not specify, you will be bridging to the USB in the live classroom environment. For those of you connecting online, you'll be using the VPN adapter, and it's a lot less of an issue for you there. All right. So the drive itself does come with some 7-zip executables that will help you extract those virtual machines, slightly better compression, and lets us squeeze on more onto this thumb drive. You may already have a solution. Feel free to use the one you already have. These are just the ones we've tested most thoroughly. The newer versions may be a little faster, but these are the ones we are having shipped with the thumb drive because we know they work. All right, so you can install those if needed. Do keep in mind as well that your host antivirus solution may be, just by viewing this directory, may be having an issue. You notice here on slide 19, we have a CA_setup executable. This is a kanenable, often flagged. The installer is flagged by antivirus as malicious, and it might delete it right away. So this is also a good test for your host antivirus. You should have your host antivirus entirely disabled. This is a hard problem for many of us. We try to disable it, and then it gets re-enabled. Whether it's Windows Defender or a third-party solution, we might also have something we think of as an endpoint security product, and we don't think of it as being antivirus. And it might also do antivirus-like defenses that gets in the way of our exercises. So even if you're operating and doing this inside of a virtual machine, the host antivirus might detect that in the memory operation and confuse our exercises. So be aware of those issues, and you know, depending upon different products, different ways that can manifest. But don't be surprised if that happens. If it does quarantine some malware, you'll want to remove it from the quarantine after you correct it, and maybe make an exception for the drive or a folder that you copy it to, so that you won't have that complication. So it's usually fastest to copy those compressed files over to your system drive and then extract them. If you're really short on space, you can extract them directly from the thumb drive, from the USB drive, but it tends to be a lot slower for most people. Once they are extracted, you can just open up these virtual machines in a VMware. I'm using Fusion today. You may have a workstation on Windows. You may have VirtualBox. And they all might have different subtle issues. The most success we have is with VMware Workstation, a modern VMware workstation. You may have to upgrade to a newer version to open up this virtual machine. Depends on how old yours is. Good idea to have the latest version, even just for this course, because it is faster and has less complications. So once you have this extracted, if you have to import it into a different virtual solution that isn't VMware Workstation, you can just operate on the virtual drive itself. You see this VMDK here on the screen on slide 20. You can import that in. But if you are using VMware, you can just open it. Don't do file new virtual machine. It may be new to you, but it already exists. So you want to open it, not do new. All right. You could open it via that VMX file, and it should just naturally work with VMware. So VMware is going to detect that this virtual machine was not in the same place it was last time when we made it. So you will always want to answer, "I copied it." There were a few versions of VMware where this was not as important, but it's a good habit to always say, "I copied it." There's a few back-end things VMware does. One of the primary things is if it auto-generates a hardware MAC address, it does a better job of not colliding with other people on the same network. And this does apply whether you're in the live classroom or doing this over VPN. We have similar MAC issues. So always answer, "I copied it." Just a good habit. There's really no benefit to saying, "I moved it," in our situation. All right. So you should get that. If you don't get this dialogue, that don't worry about it. But again, if you do see it, always answer, "I copied it." As you're getting set up here on the Windows 10 virtual machine, you're going to log on with a user ID of student, and the password is sans institute. No spaces or abbreviations, all lowercase. And there is a password hint. Once you log in, highly recommend that you send Control-Alt-Delete to the virtual machine. You do it from the VMware menu under the virtual machine menu, or you can use Control-Alt-Insert on Workstation. We'll actually pass that through. And this will give you the option to click on Change My Password, change it to something. It doesn't have to be too secure. You still want to be able to remember it. You don't want to start over. But this helps us from the accidental, when people are remote desktoping in, maybe they do a similar IP address and it happens to be somebody on the same exercise and they accidentally type in your IP address instead of theirs. This is just one of those safeties that kind of keeps us from stomping over the top of each other. Okay. So change the password to a new one and, don't forget it. And then, you know, I highly advise you to make a new snapshot once you get set up so that you can revert back to it. Even if you did forget the password, if you have Windows open and make a snapshot, you can revert back to that situation where you can change the password again from using like a net command. A net user command will let you change the password instead of just Control-Alt-Delete. So you have a few options there, but if you are worried about breaking that, don't be. You can always, in the worst case, re-extract it. Just use what's convenient for you. Now, there is a shortcut on your Windows 10 desktop that says Network Settings. You can double-click on that, and you'll get the a network control panel applet of changing your network properties. Inside of there, you can double click on IPv4, or you can select it and right click. But you want to get into the properties either way. You're going to set this IP address to, in the live classroom, the IP address we will assign. We do this manually to avoid unnecessary complications. It's a little more convenient for us to do it by hand. And it's a good reminder of what our IP address is. Instead of it being automatic and maybe you go for lunch and come back, the IP address changes, you have it statically set. It's a little more convenient for us in the classroom. For those of you connecting to the online lab system, you will actually be assigned a dynamic one since it is handled by the VPN connection process. It's not something you have to manually set up. You just have to be on a network that you can eventually get to the VPN and you'll be fine. You will, though, need to come in and see what your IP address is. You will need to set a DNS server of 10.10.10.78. That's our lab DNS server. We'll be using it for several of our exercises. Really, 661 through 663. We'll be using it quite heavily. And it's convenient to have for other things later in the week, later in the material. All right. Once you have this set up, you should be able to ping files.660.org. And if you get a reply back, chances are everything's going to be working fine. Okay. So make sure you've got this set up. Click OK. And click OK on the other dialog that's behind the one that we have on the screen here on slide 23. There's going to be a network adapter listing of IPv6 and IPv4 that got you here. And make sure an OK on that dialog as well to make sure everything's been saved. You're going to do the same thing with Linux, mostly. We've got a modified version of Kali Linux. We forked in 2016 from Kali Rolling 2016, and we've made a lot of changes. We have certain applications, like, for example, we'll be using Loki, a Python tool that will, well, it's not a Python tool, it's a network attack tool written in Python, but its Python library requirements are very specific. And we've had a problem in the past where an update to Kali destroys the capability of this tool to function correctly. So we've forked and kept things the way we needed it for our software. You've probably encountered that in the past if you've used Kali, where a tool is working fine, you update Kali, and now that tool no longer works. You update Kali to fix another tool, and now a different tool stops working. It's pretty common when a tool like Kali is so useful and it has so many different things installed. There's just too many moving variables there. You just expect it not to work sometimes. So we have one that has our labs on it, as well as we've tested it very thoroughly for our exercises. So you may have your own. On your own time, you might want to use Kali. But for our exercises, these are the ones that match most closely when you use our virtual machine. So similarly, extract this out. Run it by opening the VMX file, and you should be ready to go. Again, you'll get that dialog. You also want to say, I copied it. And you log in with root, and root backwards is the password here. T-O-O-R, as in tour. Once you're in there, go ahead and open up a terminal from the icon of the desktop, and it's a good idea to change your root password. The PSSWD command is the command that will let you change that password. Again, this is a convenience for us. You don't have to change it, but it's nice to have it different. But don't make it so complicated you've created a technical support problem for yourself. Okay. Also in your terminal, you will want to change the network adapter setup. For the live classroom, again, we're assigning those IP addresses. You're going to be using the same number we assigned for that final octet. Here we have ifconfig eth0.10.10.xx, but don't literally type xx. You'll be typing 75 dot the number we assign you. So, like maybe you're the first person in the classroom we started assigning with. It will be 101, and that would show up as 10.10.75.101. NetMask, we're using a class C, a slash 16. This will allow you to interact with the targets. And if you want to optionally work with a willing friend, you can do things across the network with each other on a case-by-case basis. So if we bring this up, you'll also want to set up a name server to test that. Echo name server 10.10.10.78 to etc.resolve.conf file as shown. And now you'll be set up similarly to your Windows virtual machine. You could try to ping back and forth between your virtual machines, but we want to be sure that we're on the right network before we get to that step. Here under the virtual machine networking on slide 28, this is the virtual machine settings you can check on both Windows 10 and your Class Kali image. Go in and look at that network adapter. It's going to probably be set to bridged and automatic. That is correct. This is the virtual machine's perspective. So it's as if you're plugging the virtual machine into a different network. This is where you're telling it what it is. There are reasons you might want to switch to network address translation or host only or some custom network. But for our purposes in the classroom, you want to be bridged to a network here. The problem is you still have to tell your host which network do you want it to bridge to. Automatic is a bad idea. Automatic is going to often have complications. It may automatically change which network it's connected to. Now, if we go up to the File Edit menu in VMware Workstation, we can get to this dialog. It looks a little different if you're using VMware Player, and it's different yet again with Fusion, and of course VirtualBox has its own way of doing it. But the point here is we're editing it for all of VMware, not just for a specific virtual machine. So this slide 29 is not showing you the virtual machine's perspective. This is VMware itself. What we do here is we want to go in and change a VMnet 0 as shown here. We want it to not be auto. Okay. See how I have VMnet 0 bridged to auto? You're going to want to change that. Now, it may, depending upon your version of virtual of VMware, it may not show you that virtual network. You might have to go down here, somewhere around in this neighborhood, where I've got highlighted near the help button, is going to be a change settings button. You may have to click on that. You get a UAC dialog, and after you answer OK, you'll get the visual that we have, the screenshot on page 29 here. And depending upon what hardware you have, you're going to have a different selection of things to pick on here. The machine I made the screenshot with happened to be a ThinkPad, and it was using an Intel gigabit network adapter, and I was using it in the live classroom, so I selected the Intel gigabit network adapter. I don't want it to automatically decide. The problem with auto is it might decide to bridge to the Wi-Fi, it might switch over to Ethernet. I've even seen it switch to FireWire sometimes on older laptop that had something connected to FireWire. Automatic is a bad thing here. You want to set it to bridge to something else. So whichever you have, if it's not showing your Ethernet, it might be that you're using a USB Ethernet, and it may be either turned off by the host in a power saving situation. And even if it isn't even visually on USB, I've seen laptop models that have this on the USB bus, and it's just still not in this list. So what you'll need to do is find it in the list. If you don't see it, you've got to find out why your network adapter isn't listed. Okay, so you're going to have to experiment on your own and get a network adapter you can bridge to. So for those of us that aren't connected physically with Ethernet in the live classroom, if you're connecting via the online sessions on demand, what you'll need to do is you'll need to follow the instructions provided by SANS. This is actually at connect.labs.sans.org, and that will be the current instructions for connecting to this environment. You will connect your virtual machine individually to this VPN. OpenVPN is already installed. You'll just have to install the files for the certificates and change some configurations, and then your virtual machines will be connected. It's a little less of an issue that way. You can actually be in NAT or in Bridged, as long as your virtual machines can get out and establish their VPN connections and connect to that URL. Again, that's connect.labs.sans.org, and you'll get those instructions if you're connecting online. For those of us that are connecting with just Ethernet, you don't need to be connected to that. All right. Keep in mind that, yes, situations change. So what might be working fine, you may have to go back and revisit this and get set up again. As long as you can ping files.sec660.org and get an answer that should come back with 10.10.10.7.0, then you know that you're connected to the right network and you have that access. All right. So we like to ping that and be set up fine. Now that we're set up and connected to our lab environment, we can start beginning looking at actual content. Let's talk about not accessing the network for lab exercises, but the goal of an attacker to access the network. That's our goal. And we can do this in a few different ways. We'll be looking at a few different combinations we might encounter as an attacker. Okay? So let's just get in started here. You know, network attacks in general, at a high level view, we want to gain access, right? That's our point. And historically, we've been able to, many years ago, you know, remote access, remote attacks were much more common. We have a lot less of that in our day-to-day lives and in security now, where we can, you know, run a scan and find a service that's exposed and vulnerable, and we happen to have an exploit for that service and break in. Right? We're getting better at having organizations, anyways, are getting better at having firewalls and things that are patched, and it's just a lot less of the initial attack vector. Phishing is much more common, and also physical access. So we're looking at some of those things as we talk about this, but our perspective really is the most common things that we have. I'm one of those guys in a penetration test that takes great advantage of my obscure knowledge. Very peculiar. I've seen this before. This is a very special device, and I can go in and manipulate that. And that's why I'm successful, is because I know something somebody else doesn't. And that's great. And it, you know, gives me reason to constantly study and improve and find all these vulnerabilities on things that I don't expect people to recognize. But for the course, we're going to focus on the more common things because it applies to more environments and then therefore more activities, more penetration tests. So we're going to break it up into little pieces. Getting some kind of a foothold to the network, then manipulating the network to gain better access, and then taking advantage of the network itself, such as we'll be doing some route injection so that we can better manipulate beyond the network and take advantage of the network setup. So initially, let's get our access. We want to get that foothold, or maybe we don't quite have what we think of as a foothold. Maybe it's something a little bit more of a, maybe we describe it as a toehold, something that's not quite as good of a starting point. Generally speaking, you know, modern networks are complex. There's a lot more going on. There's changes. It's not clean. It might be very complicated. Beyond just, is there a defense we have to deal with? Of course, if an organization has had breaches that have involved network access, or someone's just plugged in and done something, they will have some compliance checks and there might be some security features involved. And that's basically the first thing we're going to address, is what kinds of things will get in the way of our initial access. Now, just like most things when it comes to penetration testing, we can try to find things that are unknown and say, gee, defenders, you should really fix this. Or we can manipulate those things that are there and provide it to us. So that's the first thing we're going to do to get sufficient access to mount true attacks. We're going to take advantage of what access we do have. When we get to the point of manipulating the network, we're going to do things like ARP poisoning or other manipulations to take advantage of those network technologies and get access to something more interesting to us as the attacker. A hijacking an application, maybe getting into some data that is only provided from a certain endpoint. I mean, there's lots of potential here. It will be depending upon what we find, of course. And then we'll exploit the network conditions itself. You know, like maybe we want to spoof a workstation. So there's an administrative workstation that's only allowed, is the only allowed device to connect to it. We'll want to pretend to be that or come in the middle of it and manipulate what it's doing. Or maybe there's things that are done to manage the network devices themselves. SNMP and Trivial File Protocol, TFTP, are used to change configurations often, in addition to some of the different GUIs that are out there. Typically, loading firmware configurations is done via Trivial File Transfer Protocol. Even if it's managed with the web interface, it's often transferred with that. That gives us an opportunity for, again, exploiting those devices and getting better access. Now on slide 36, let's talk from a hypothetical. These attacks are conditional on several different things, but let's just start from something that we can get some context on. Let's say we're in a situation as an attacker where we can have physical access to a network port. Right? Maybe I'm a job candidate and I came for an interview and I'm in a conference room and there's an exposed network port. Or I'm in a common area, one we did recently, a little pen test assessment. We're in a common area in a student dormitory and the vending machine was plugged into a Cat5 socket. We could plug into that and use its connection. Those are the kinds of things we're talking about. Now, that network port itself might be restricted. It might be designed for people to just connect to, or maybe it's very special. It's used for printers or voice over IP, or it's used for some other things. Whatever it is, we'll have to plug in and see what we can do to take advantage of that network and if we can get beyond that provided network. Maybe, again, it's a configuration challenge or it's a defense specifically to get in the way. We'll need to bypass those things. The first opportunity we have, network admission control. Some vendors will call it network access control or network access protection and call it NAP. It really doesn't matter what is being sold, but there are even the slightly different meanings are usually with the same goal of preventing the casual attacker plugging in and taking advantage of your network. Or maybe it's a traveler and they've got their mobile device. It is a legitimate device for the network. It's even owned by the organization, but it's been out and about. It's been on the Starbucks Wi-Fi or it's been some other unknown network connected to it. And it'd be nice to be able to validate that that machine is healthy and capable of connecting to our network. So one of the things that we can do when we plug into a network, we can have our network architecture set up and isolated. We can have our network access control, network admission control, check to say, wait, do you have your current antivirus signatures? Do you have your current Windows updates? And check that. And if everything checks out, then they can participate in the normal Windows network, for example. Or maybe they need to be on a quarantine network and say, yeah, you need to go download those updates. You need to do your antivirus scan or let us scan you and validate that you're okay to participate in the network because you've been disconnected for a while. And that's a great value of this kind of technology. It's not just for rogue devices, but devices that, you know, may need a little cleanup before they're connected and participating in the network. Our first scenario is something that's, a pretty common one, a dissolvable agent or a clientless NAC. I see this. My favorite example is a university situation where you might have many different students have their own personal devices, for example, that want to participate in the network. But it's something that we want to handle whatever checks we can do without installing a third-party tool. It's just, it would be a support nightmare for somebody like a university to force everybody to install a program. And, you know, they'd have different hardware, different software, different OSs, different needs. And it, then, you know, you also don't want to be blamed for things that go wrong after you've installed this software. So it makes sense that it would be a very nice thing to have a clientless NAC, something that would just run via like a captive portal when the device tries to connect somewhere. Component-wise, this is implemented with, we have a switch of some kind, maybe it is wireless, maybe it's wired, but we have a switch and we have some content, a captive portal that hijacks the HTTP connection, redirects to a captive portal page, and forces the checks. Okay. Once those checks are successful, then the user can reconnect and or just continue to use that access. All right. So our first example here, captive portal authentication. We have, again, the ability to present to the user something. It might be running inside a client browser window, doing some checks in the background, checking to see, is it the browser up to date? Are there certain things? Do I even know this user already? Maybe there's a cookie from a previous login, or they just need to be presented with a login form. And we also see something similar in commercial access points, where your authentication is really usually a credit card number, you know, some form of payment, not just a username and password. We see a variety of different captive portal situations, but technically they run in a similar way. If this is ran out of band, it would need to handle in a graceful way. We need to handle that authentication and detect when somebody's trying to access the network so that they could get it. Once the access is done, it can turn back on the access. Inline tends to be the most realistic here because it's easiest to prevent the access and redirect everything to this access point. Out-of-band management is good for situations where you might be disconnected and want to reconnect without invalidating an application. Like if I had something making SSH connections, for example, or SSL style connections, I don't want a captive portal to, you know, interrupt that, but I can have it done on the side. That would be okay. So mostly it's inline, but maybe it's something else. Either way, the network connection, once authenticated, is changed to give us the access that is appropriate. In most of these situations, we see an IP address and MAC address is one of the things, one of the factors that the captive portal system would actually track to know if you are still authenticated after you have your initial access. Now, if the login we previously talked about was the normal way, we can ask ourselves, how would we attack this? Well, we have several attack opportunities. I could try to see if there's a flaw in the captive portal itself. You know, I'd do our web style attacks. Maybe there's a command line injection or some kind of a flaw in SQL that the web form connects to. Maybe there's some other protocol on the server itself that is not intended to be used and we can take advantage of it. We also do keep in mind we have authentication and name services that have to happen before that access to the captive portal is even presented to the user, right? DNS has to happen. DHCP has to provide an address. And maybe there's something there we can manipulate. Like, for example, we could attack that and make a legitimate user come to us by spoofing the DNS and the addresses of the captive portal. And we can collect those credentials. That's one way to do it. Maybe there's something else we could do. But I like to think about those kinds of conditions. You know, I can steal legitimate access as somebody else tries to connect. Well, let's look at some of those examples. Here we have a screenshot of Kane that we're exploiting web authentication. Kane's a simple, Kane has a lot of different features, but it's one we're looking at here is a simple sniffer that just collects, based on different protocols, like here we're showing HTTP, known username password combinations. Not the usernames or passwords themselves being known, but really looking for the HTML fields and HTTP parameters, get or post variables that would look like a username or password. Things like user, username, user ID, login, login ID. Those are all common username fields that it looks for, as well as password, pass, auth, all these different kinds of things that represent passwords. It looks for those strings. And if Kane can see that traffic, because it's in the middle, or it's been able to see it go by on a broadcast, theoretically, it can collect that information. And if it matches, it can say, look, I happen to see a username and password combination. This works great if you can be in the middle of a legitimate, because then you can record legitimate username and passwords. Although I've seen during different projects, we do an assessment and someone will try to do a password guesser and at the same time try to run Kane and collect usernames and passwords. And they're getting the attempts. You know, maybe the user typed his password wrong. You got his attempt, or your password guesser is trying different passwords and you're collecting that as the attacker here. You don't know that it's successful. You're just getting the attempt. Okay. But it's still more likely than not give you valid passwords. Of course, we haven't talked about dealing with SSL. This is something we still find in captive portals. And the reason is, again, if the captive portal has to hijack HTTP and redirect you to a login form to force you to authenticate, HTTPS can't happen yet. It's important to have that, and we have HTTPS in a lot of our sites we go to, but if the captive portal has to break HTTPS or have it not be there in order to redirect anyway, it's a feature that it can redirect. So often this can be done with HTTP because the solution already had to redirect to an HTTP site so that it could present, hey, wait a minute, you can't go to that website that needs HTTPS. You need to authenticate to the captive portal first. And so if it stays in HTTP, we can observe those usernames and passwords. We'll come back to complications on that later, but don't be surprised if this still works in your situation, because it has to be able to, again, provide you and redirect your website to the captive portal. It can't do that if a true secure tunnel has already been established. So just as a feature, it has to be able to do this. Now, as an attacker, if I can impersonate that valid one, that valid user and password, I've collected it, that's great. Now I can use their credentials. But maybe I don't collect that. I can just wait for somebody to authenticate, and now I can just use their addresses. I can be their MAC address, their IP address, and now I can get the same access they would have. Of course, if that user is actively browsing websites, it's not going to work right. You know, we'll be fighting over, there'll be a conflict, a MAC address or IP address or both, and we're going to fight over that. The traffic will be coming back to one or both of us, and it's going to just not work right. But we can take advantage of this still as an attacker. You know, I'm guilty of this as much as the next person. I'll be logging into a hotel Wi-Fi or any kind of Wi-Fi, for example. Even if I'm at home and I'm not on Wi-Fi, I'm plugged into the Ethernet, I don't find the logout page. I just close my laptop and walk away, or my machine sleeps because I'm no longer using it. I don't find the logout page. And what an attacker could do is find that. That's a great opportunity. A recently departed but still authenticated user is perfect for us to steal their identity. We can impersonate their MAC address by a few different techniques. On Windows, we can use a MAC shift tool to change it. We might be able to make a network adapter change in the network properties. Kind of depends on what our network adapter is, how flexible we can change our hardware address. It's a little more convenient on non-Windows devices. We can use ifconfig in this example here. We're changing the Ethernet hardware address. Mac OS, Linux, I mean, it's pretty much doesn't matter what it is. There's usually a way to change that. Again, sometimes the specific network adapter may make it difficult to change this, and we'll have to find a way around it. Okay. Driver, it's really the firmware and the driver interaction that may get in the way of how we're doing this. I'll also say, too, those of you who may be using VirtualBox, this can be difficult because VirtualBox defines in its hardware configuration the Ethernet address. It may not work the same just because you're using VirtualBox. It may be harder to change your MAC address with a simple command, as we show here, when you have to actually change it in the firmware. Even though it's virtual firmware, you can't change it with the ifconfig command, as we show here. An example of a tool that could hijack a recently departed user is CPSCAM. CPSCAM stands for Captive Portal Scam. It's a tool that, again, its purpose is to watch for machines once they don't see any more traffic. The tool doesn't see more traffic for, you know, 2 minutes. Then it will tell you, hey, this host with this MAC address has been inactive, and now maybe that's a good candidate to do. You know, they're still authenticated. The tokens are still valid. We just can resume their activity. If it's still active, again, we're going to have a conflict. If it's too inactive for, you know, a day, then none of the authentication is going to be, if it's still inactive for a day, then none of the authentication is going to be valid. Now, do keep in mind that every time you see the word bypass in security, you know, what does that really mean? It doesn't necessarily mean defeat directly. It usually means avoid, right? So one way we could avoid authentications, again, conditionally, depending upon what we have involved, we might find that there are some devices that are excluded from those checks, okay? This isn't necessarily that the device doesn't support the solution, like 802.1x, with a particular vendor, but maybe it's the organization doesn't support it, right? Maybe they decide that, well, people want to be able to move around printers. We've had problems with printers not working. So these printers, these hardware addresses are whitelisted. They will always work no matter where they're plugged in, right? They don't have to go through some kind of authentication check. Now, I know that, for example, Hewlett-Packard HP printers are capable of doing 802.1x authentication. It's just that sometimes, again, that the organization doesn't support it. They don't like changing it. Maybe they have a password rotation policy, and this qualifies under that. They don't want to go around and change the password every 30 days or something silly like that. They just have it whitelisted as an exception. Okay? But you can look for differences in hardware. And, for example, you know, you have a Cisco shop, you know, the organization uses Cisco gear everywhere, but then they have some very special other kinds of non-Cisco equipment. That's more likely to be accepted. It's likely to be there, but not necessarily supported by the MAC vendor, but maybe the organization, again, doesn't really have it integrated in the correct way. Those are the kinds of things we're looking for. Every organization is going to be different, but it's a good chance, a good opportunity for an attacker to find something. The network access control system generally is going to validate that system by checking its hardware address. Now, for convenience, again, we find a lot of this in place. The whole hardware address isn't learned and trusted, but the prefix of this, the OUI, the manufacturer's range that the IEEE organization is assigned for their hardware adapters. Here, you guys use these hardware addresses. They're for you. And they're supposed to be globally unique that they assign to their devices as OEMs and then as manufacturers and then as users, as system integrators. We actually just use them. They're all supposed to be unique. There are usually, though, other combinations that come into play where the NAC vendor might say, wait a minute, You're that hardware address, but now you're using a different user agent. You know, something's up with this. That's not the same. And maybe it's not just a defensive technique. It may be, again, take, for example, a captive portal that charges money. I see this on flights all the time that provide Wi-Fi. They charge a different cost for, a portable device that's small physically, because the user's going to tend to be using it less, than a laptop device. So by identifying the browser user agent or the OS itself, the captive portal solution may decide that there's different authentication required. Wait, you're going to use this application? Well, that costs more money because it uses more data. Or, hey, you're using a desktop system, you're going to be using it more than if you're using a portable device. So, you have different requirements there. And some of this might actually be dynamically in, this is the main goal of our clientless provider that we mentioned, done in something like JavaScript, in browser validation of the operating system, to check to say, all right, what does it look like? Not just claiming with the user agent string that you're this, but let's check a few things. Do you have this plugin? Do you have these things? And even if it's me doing a fingerprint of your host in general, and not just a specific thing I'm looking for, I can just use it to say, has something changed? Maybe if you update, for example, plugins or a new flash, for example, a new flash release happened for security reasons. If I have a JavaScript validation, you can check to see what version of Flash you're using and decide to redirect you to the update page again. If this was like in a corporate environment, that's a good thing to do, is to check for those older things that are known vulnerabilities or known updates exist for, force you to get those updates before you can continue. So I like to look at this as a challenge as an attacker. I may have to modify certain things and tailor my spoofing so that I can better approximate a legitimate user. In the real world and in the classroom here, we will be using iOS 10 version as our impersonation target. I like to use this a lot because I find that it's still accepted. Even though, we have newer versions of these things, but older devices are still accepted because, again, they have less features. So, I like impersonating iOS 10 because I get some side effects that are valuable to me. It's often accepted because it's older and it just has to work, and there's not as much mobile device management capability for the older devices. Some little bit of legacy entering in now. So there's a lot of reasons to go with iOS 10. It seems to work really reliably for me. But again, any situation might be different. Maybe you need to profile your attack surface here and find out what is going to be accepted. Whichever thing that you're trying to impersonate happens to be there, you're going to try to map out those same settings. So there are a few utilities that come in handy with this. You could use any kind of a web proxy, really, like burp in proxy mode. You can use to change any headers that would let you mimic a specific device. I like to use the user agent switcher. There's one for Chrome or Firefox and many other browsers out there now. Some of them work better than others, and they let you change most of the attributes about a browser. Considered to be a quick and dirty 80% of the spoofing for 20% of the effort type plugin. We can change the description and change our user agent and many other things here. I use this many times too when I need, I don't feel comfortable with the browser rendering of the page. I often use it when I want to read like a document and I don't want a lot of advertisements. I'll make it look like I'm using an iPad because I don't get flash advertisements. I get a little less advertisements. They're less offensive to me, less interruptive. So I use it even when I'm not trying to break into the network. But again, you're trying to mimic a specific device or a set of devices here. What you actually want to change this to, depends on what is accepted. So you'll want to try to guess intelligently or fingerprint an existing one that lets you know what those settings are. Right? Maybe I, as an attacker, send a phishing email and get somebody to click on a benign web page that I host as the attacker. And then I can kind of see what their fields are they're using for their browser. I can tell what user agent and what app version and platform and everything else is set to. And then I can just go and use my plugin to set to those specific settings. Now, depending upon the solution, this by itself isn't going to be enough. I might have to go a little further, but this is definitely one of the things that is done. One of the additional checks vendors have added is TCP stack fingerprinting. Here is an example of one of the techniques. The idea is if maybe a paying user authenticated with a mobile device and then wants to connect with a different device, that it's going to say, hey, wait a minute, you can't use those credentials anymore. You connected as this, or you paid for a specific application to work, but you're also sending other traffic. The P0F tool is a passive fingerprinting tool. It's a great original passive tool, like the name implies, literally. I guess I should say it doesn't imply it. It's literally in the name. It doesn't interact with either endpoints. It just watches and observes and says, wait a minute, the order of TCP options you're using, or the fact that your time to live is set to this in the packets, then it's going to be able to identify what it is. And it's not that passive OS fingerprinting by itself validates something, but if you combine the user agent string and what should actually be matched with in combination with this, again, if somebody's trying to become an existing connection, an existing user who has passed their validation, a solution might say, hey, wait a minute. This is not adding up. You say you're an Apple device, but your packets look like it's actually Windows or something else. And again, commercial solutions that may be doing this for paid access, they have financial incentives to force you to re-authenticate, say, wait a minute, give us more money because this is a separate device. It's really a different device. For enterprise defense situations, you could, again, detect that somebody's maliciously attempting to become somebody else who is authentic on the network. One of the things you could do to counter this defense as an attacker is to go through and more intimately modify your system to mimic what it is. Here we have an example of, again, of trying to focus on iOS 10. We changed the time to live and the default window size and selected acknowledgments and things like that, save it to a profile, and we can switch to that. This tool ultimately changes some registry settings. It can't do everything, but it can do many of the settings we need. I actually prefer to use a proxy to do the tampering and to scrub the packets and make it look like something else personally, because it gives me a better control, and then I don't mess too much with registry settings on my attack machines. Again, this doesn't take everything, like the TCP options themselves. I would need to rewrite the packets to, better look like something else entirely. This does give us some capability, though. Also keep in mind that most of the NAC solutions, for efficiency reasons, do not check every single packet. It's not the first thing that didn't work, or the first thing that was obscure and didn't add up detects it and it redirects. But, for example, Cisco, just by example, it'll only validate that on 5-minute intervals. That's the smallest, most finest setting you could do, is every 5 minutes, it's going to say, wait a minute, this isn't right, and kick that off. So even if we weren't really clever as an attacker and didn't get by all the network access control checks, we would still get a 5-minute window of time, theoretically, to conduct our attack. Okay? And we can keep redoing that. So let's say I send out my observed, mimicked iPad settings, send out my traffic, and then I set my normal stuff. It opens the door or keeps the door open long enough for me to conduct my attack. I could also, though, generate spoof traffic that makes it look like the legitimate one. And just replay that. So there's a few options. What we have in this example, though, in the hypothetical, is we have a few IP tables commands. This minus capital F, I just want to mention that it's going to flush out some rules. And then this A that we have for the output table here, we're going to say, you know, anything that is coming to port 80 and has a reset flag from, that's the minus S, the source, 10.10.10.104 to 10.10.10.110 in this example, we're going to drop it. We're going to drop resets. And what this is going to do is basically just ignore those resets. See, if I'm sending traffic to mimic something, I don't want it to actually come back to my host and have it try to answer it. So I'm dropping traffic so that, like when my attacking machine spoofs something, I want to drop the resets my attacking machine would say when the legitimate machine tries to reply back something that my attacking machine supposedly had sent, right? If I am spoofing, I don't really have that application. I don't want it to say, wait, what are you talking about? Reset, start over on that connection. And so that's why we drop the resets here. And here is an example of a script that will help us mimic an iPad. We will, in section 660.3, talk a lot more about Scapy and Python in general. You can read through this and see what it does without knowing much about the programming language. The value of using Scapy is it's protocol level aware. Here we're building up everything we need to mimic that, whatever the TCP options were, whatever the other headers are, and then the content level itself. As we get down into the data section, we get a URL and we get user agent string, and all these other things are set there. And again, once that's set, we send it and it just generates the traffic. Okay. If you feel like getting more in depth with this, you may want to revisit it after we talk more about Scapy in 660.3. I mentioned the JavaScript OS validation earlier. There's a couple of different ways this could happen, but again, the idea is the browser is told by the captive portal, hey, check a few things. And this could be, again, checking to see if you have the current version of the plugins, if you need those updates, or it could just be a fingerprinting mechanism. Instead of just looking at the way the packets are being sent, by injecting code into the browser, this solution can actually check to see if you're just different than what you used to be. The idea is to catch, you know, someone stealing access from an authenticated device. If it remembers what these things are, it can see if it's changed, depending upon, again, those situations. So this little snippet is not from a true captive portal, but it proves the same test. Here it's looking for all the navigator attributes, and it just prints it out for diagnostics. You can see it. But if any of these, again, are recorded and then compared to see if they're changed, you could tell that somebody is recording it. Also, too, I might just say, you know what? Our standard system build is, you know, IE11 with this version and all this other stuff. If none of that matches, then you need to go do updates. Go to this other network and do updates. Don't go to our real network. Okay? So we have that kind of functionality. And this can be fun to play with. I did a proof of concept years ago now. Even came down to a DEF CON talk. It was a DEF CON 16, I think. It was a while ago now. But the idea was when there was a fingerprinting like this, I could actually inject malicious code into my own browser that would tamper with the other code that the captive portal was injecting. See, this does run in the browser. So if the captive portal is trusting this to evaluate it correctly, then you're actually giving the attacker the code to run and assuming it's running it correctly when you look at the answers. So, you know, point, counterpoint, and counterpoint again. As the attacker, I can make this lie as much as I like. I can do this with just the browser configuration settings. Here in this Firefox example, we're using about config to look at those settings. We go down and we see just some things we can change, the strings, to, again, mimic another environment. You may not know what you need to mimic, but you can go through and fingerprint things, and through trial and error, maybe you can get it correct. These settings, by the way, do change less with mobile devices. Again, one reason that I like to pick on iOS 10, it's my go-to because it's older, and it's often accepted because it's older, and you know, maybe there's an executive with a favorite iPad, you know, it's running iOS 10 or 9 even, because it's a really old iPad, and it can't be upgraded to a new iOS. Those kinds of things are gold to us as an attacker, because once you identify these settings, they don't get changed. For our first exercise, we'll actually be bypassing a captive portal solution. Our goal is to get access to this game. That's our context for this exercise. It's called World of Phaos. This is a web server. It's a multiple player game. The idea in our scenario here is that there is a network access control that is going to protect access to these beta gaming testing centers and your testing servers, and you're going to attack the network access control system itself. There are actual flaws in the gaming application itself, but that's not the emphasis of this exercise. In order to get there, you'll have to bypass the network access control server. So we'll be doing this with Kali for this exercise. You won't need the Windows 10 for the initial portion. I'm going to introduce this exercise and then pause so that you can work through this on your own. And then I will walk through how you would actually solve it. To set yourself up for this exercise, though, we did not have a gateway for our other exercises. This is the only exercise where we need a gateway. So you can manually add one to Kali with the command shown on page 57 here. Route add net 192.168.10/24/gateway10.10.10.69. Don't add a default gateway because then it would be any traffic. Here we're just sending, you know, specifically if we know this beta network that we are targeting is on 192.168.1, which you would know if you did a name lookup for wophaos.sec6v.org, that it actually has an IP address in the 192.168 range. Okay. We have this special gateway, which happens to be the captive portal, 10.10.10.69, that you have to pass through to get to that environment. All right. So you'll need to set that up with this individual command. Now, if you make any other networking changes, since this is a dynamic route that you've added, well, it's a static route when you add it, but you have added it. It's not something that your default gateway remembers or anything. If you change your network settings, you will have to rerun this route command if it is no longer in place. So do keep that in mind. If you make change something about your network, you may want to revisit adding this route back in. Now, what's going to happen is in this screenshot on 58, your access attempt, you will try to browse to that URL we just said, the wophaos.sec6v.org, but it's going to redirect you to the captive portal, the cp.sec6v.org. This isn't we didn't type this in. It redirected us here, and it asking for a username and password. We're not going to have this, so we're going to try to work around this access, okay? So that is your challenge. Answers will follow this. I'm going to pause so that you have an opportunity to work through the challenge on your own, and then I will demonstrate the solution. The solutions are in the slides, but I'm not going to walk through the slides. They're there for your reference. If you need help, you will learn so much more if you do this on your own. Okay. Again, you have to be connected to the lab environment for this to work. It's also a good little test for us to ensure that everything is connected appropriately before we go to the more complicated exercises later.